Blog Talk Radio.
Happy 5th of July, everybody, and welcome to the one and only ScaryCast. This is Dr. John Stamey. I am live from Myrtle Beach, South Carolina, and we've got a great guest tonight. We've got great co-hosts, and we've got a guest co-host, but more importantly, it is July the 5th, 2021, and we have a hurricane update from none other than Billy the Kid, William H. Cox II, who is currently located in and around Vero Beach, Florida tonight. Billy, how are you doing, and what's going on with this hurricane?
Oh, man, it's just raining right now. The hurricane is it's leaving Cuba right now. It's hitting it pretty hard. It's supposed to hit Key West tonight, and then it's going to go out a little bit. It's going to go west a little bit, and it's going to curve and hit Tampa. And it's going to cross over the state, and you know, and then it's going to go up the East Coast, and it's supposed to hit, you know, South Carolina, Georgia. It's just going to go up the East Coast. Yeah.
So are you telling – we see on Saturday, Friday night when they announced a new hurricane forecast, I looked at my friends and I said, it's going to hit Charleston and then Myrtle Beach. And I swear they have the hurricane track hitting Charleston and then bouncing to Myrtle Beach. So we're going to have to watch very carefully. I sure as heck don't want to get all hurricaned out here this early in the season. It's just going to be too scary with all that hurricane. And speaking of a major hurricane, the man that might get hit along with me, the greatest wrestler in Ravenel, South Carolina, the one and only Amazing Velvet. How are you doing tonight, Velvet?
I'm good, good, good. We just had a couple of complications at the house. I had to take care of some stuff, but good to go. Yeah, we might get hit with some rain, probably about it. I don't expect too much from it. So
You are the optimist. I am the pessimist. I remember I was talking with Billy the Kid earlier today, and he was talking about, well, it might only be a Category 1 hurricane. The last Category 1 hurricane destroyed Pawleys Island and Merle's Inlet. Our mailboxes in our condo community got totally ravaged. We had no power for a week. Everything in and I learned one thing. Everybody needs to listen. If you've got a hurricane coming, boil your eggs. Don't let them just sit there and say, oh, they'll be okay. Boil your eggs. At least you'll have something to eat. So I learned that the hard way. That's Dr. John's hurricane advice. Boil your eggs, and you can at least have hard-boiled eggs. Make sure you got some salt, and they'll all be good. Anyway, it's great to have everybody here. We've introduced the Amazing Velvet. We have introduced Billy the Kid. And from Camden, South Carolina, the Surgeon General of ScaryCast, Dr. Trey Donaway. How are you doing tonight,
Yay.
Buddy?
I'm very optimistic, John. I don't think right now it's not even a hurricane. It's just a tropical storm. So it's already fallen down from the hurricane status, and by the time to get
yep.
us, it's showing a D, which just means a depression,
yep.
which is just rain. I think the only real depression there's going to be is all the weather forecasters are depressed. They're eager for a hurricane because they've got footage of stoplights swinging in the wind and palmetto trees fluttering in the breeze and stop signs, you know, bouncing around from wind. So I think the only depression right now is going to be weather forecasters because I think they will be a little bit saddened by the fact that this isn't a hurricane anymore.
Well, all I got to say, I will cheer you on. I don't want any Category 1s or 2s bouncing off Charleston and Ravenel, South Carolina, and coming up here. I mean, this
Yay.
Is going to be, oh, gosh. So we
Nah,
don't want
you're fine.
Anyway, tonight I am going to start as I introduce our esteemed guest and our favorite guest here. Oh my goodness. I better be careful because I almost did not see the queen of ScaryCast herself, the none other than Robin McCray.
Robin.
How are you doing tonight?
Hey, baby. How are you?
We've got everybody here, along with Billy the Kid, and we got Trey Donaway, we got the Amazing Velvet, we got you, oh, and Devin. I'm sure Devin will be here with us. And we've got, I want to introduce John LeMay, the great paranormal author. John, how are you doing tonight?
Hey, I'm doing good here in Roswell, because we don't get hurricanes here. We get stuff called haboob. Do y'all know what a haboob is?
No, what's a haboob?
Tornado.
It's a dirt hurricane. It's true. You can Google it, haboob. It's a hurricane made of dirt. And we do get
sandstorm.
Those.
Well,
yeah, sandstorm.
Well,
fancy
as I said, and as I told you earlier, I'm going to introduce your topic tonight with two other short stories, very short ones. One, Compliments of Robin McCrae. Robin told me when I discussed with her that you were talking about Jaws, the first thing she popped up and said is, you know that came from a story up in New England. I said, no, I didn't. So Robin said, I'll send it to you. And so she sent me a story that said in 1916, four people were killed in a freshwater river by a shark. And I spoke with Trey Donaway today, and he said, well, yes, some sharks can live in both freshwater and in seawater. And there was a 10-year-old kid who got killed, very sad, in 1916. Four people were killed, and it talked about how the townspeople were absolutely on a rampage fighting this shark. So now I'm going to slip into a bull shark.
Yeah.
I'm now going to slip into paranormal mode because we've got Trey from Camden, which is right next to Bishopville and the home of the South Carolina Lizard Man. In my upcoming book, The Lizard Man Companion, everybody will find out that there have been three times in the last century when we have had sightings of Lizard Man. We've had it in 1988-89. We had it in the early 30s. And we had it in the early teens. And every one of those sighting periods was accompanied by extremely hot weather and extremely dry weather. And that encouraged a lot of marine life to move upwards from, you know, as it got dry and as the water levels decreased, you found animals from the sea and everything moving toward inland. And that's exactly what happened. I know some people say, oh, heck, the lizard man is not real. Well, it was pretty real in 1988 with 13 recorded police reports, which are, by the way, they have disappeared. It would be hard to guess that they've disappeared. But by the way, John LeMay,
I'm not trying to interrupt you. I just wanted to add something because of what you had said. I found it very, very interesting that you made the comment that they noticed this sighting in very dry, hot weather.
Yep.
If you remember, I have a picture, a very clear picture, from the shoulders up of one standing in my backyard. And the day I took that, it was almost 100 degrees here, and we had not had rain for weeks. So I just thought that was interesting. I just wanted to put that out there when you said that, because I didn't know that. But I remember distinctly when I took the picture, because it was so hot. You couldn't. Yeah, it was so hot. You couldn't stand to be outside.
Right, and I mean, you know, the weather does have to do with, let's face it, all these sightings of strange things, be they UFOs, cryptids, or whatever, the weather does have something to do with it. Now, John LeMay, I want to ask you a quick Roswell question, then we're going to get on to our topic tonight, which is one of the most famous movies ever made, one of the most frightening things I've ever seen, Jaws. But, John, in terms of Roswell and UFOs, were there any police reports about the UFOs or potential alien visitors, number one? And if there were, are those police reports still available? I know that's a put-you-on-the-spot question,
not.
But I thought it was an important question to ask.
No, absolutely not. I think the military handled everything, so there was no need for the regular, you know, town police or I would guess maybe the sheriffs might have helped with road control or something, but no reports. And all I remember is that some firemen that went out to the crash site, you know, some of their relatives and kids later got visits from the men in black, you know, threatening them to never talk about it, what their dad told them about being at the crash site. So no, definitely no police reports.
Oh, but certainly now that the big UFO report's out, they'd have all that documentation that's available for
yeah.
everybody to read, right? Because it's, you know,
yeah.
there you go. The big,
if only
the big federal, yeah, the big reveal has happened, and now everybody knows no more than we did before the reveal.
Yeah.
Is
wow.
that not amazing? It's just astounding.
And you know what? That you would have thought, I mean, there are some basic things they could have put out there, like a lot of, about, I want to say not all, but maybe 30% of the bad storms we get are created by the ETs, because that's when they bring the bigger ships in. You know, maybe give people a little warning so they know what they're up against. But no, they didn't say anything.
And Robin's right, because Noe, remember Noe Torres that we had on last month, he wrote a whole chapter in one of our Old West UFO books about a UFO hiding in a storm, and it was actually the Pascagoula, where they had the famous sighting in 1974, the Pascagoula aliens. They had a sighting also in 1875, where they had this huge UFO storm cloud pass through the town, so Robin's right.
They had back, and I want to say 2000, and I'm either 12 or 13. I want to say 12. It could have been 13. They had this storm cloud that came and went right over my house, and then it sat right over my house. And I was with a friend of mine, and we had gone into town and had something to eat and came back. And it was later on in the day, but it certainly wasn't dark yet. And that same storm cloud was still there, but it had shaped itself into a saucer. And it stayed over my house. It was over my house for 6-7 hours. And it just looked like a nasty storm cloud, but it had changed shape so that it was more saucer shaped. So I got home and I went outside and started taking pictures of it. And surprisingly enough, it took off out of there like a bat out of heck. You know? But they do. For years, they will create some of the worst storms that we've ever had. And it's strictly because then people go in the house. And it gives
well,
them more access.
Maybe on the cone designation for this track of this tropical depression now, that well, with the tropical storm, then it turns into a tropical depression. Maybe we ought to be looking, instead of the S's and the U's, we ought to be looking for an S or a D. We ought to be looking for a U, for a UFO on the cone
yep.
as it tracks up the East Coast.
Yeah, and the actual storms that they don't create, because they do create a lot of our weather issues, not all, but some. But even the storms that are really bad, because of the capabilities that they have, they will use our natural storms as well.
Sure. It'd give the radar something to look at that people would just write off as a storm.
Yeah.
Mm. Yeah.
Exactly. Well, I tell you what, this would make a good topic for another Scarycast, absolutely for sure. And now I want to ask Robin McCray. I had a request from one of our co-hosts, from Trey, today. He said, could Robin come on and be our guest? Robin, Trey Donaway wants to know if you'd like to come on and be our guest so we could ask you some questions. So do you think not
Always.
This week, but next week? Now, next week we have Mark Sargent of the Flat Earth Society, and he's going to tell us all about the Flat Earth, and he's also going to tell us about the conference that they're going to have in September. But then the week after that, which would be the 5th plus 14, it would be the 19th, we would love to have you as our guest. You would switch from co-host to guest that night. Sound good?
Sounds good to me. And I always like talking good. To Trey, so, as well as the rest of you guys.
Well, good. So Trey, there we go. We'll have Robin on the 19th, and again, Mark Sargent next week from the Flat Earth Society. And this week, we've
got. Oh, you
guys,
I can't. I will be gone. I'm speaking at a conference on the 17th. I will be gone for 2 weeks.
Okay, then when
just
you get back, when you get back, we'll have you on the show as our guest.
I'm all yours. Absolutely. Absolutely.
Okay.
We will get back the 27th.
We'll have you on the show
The 27th, that'll just give us more time to anticipate you as a guest. Because,
that's
Robin,
right.
I think you were a fascinating individual, and I'd love to learn more about
you.
how you developed these abilities and the world's reaction, your family's reaction to this, when it started, how it began.
Absolutely.
What advice you could give to other people that might be following the same path that you've gone on? I think it's just a fascinating option.
Wonderful. And at some point when we get on, it doesn't have to be when I'm on there, when we get a guest that we are talking about the UFOs and the ETs, there is some information that I was given by the ETs that I'm supposed to share. And I've been sitting on it now for about 6-7 months, trying to decide how to go about releasing it. And so I think I've got another show I'm going to do it on as well, but we should definitely put it here. If I'm going to do it somewhere else, we should do it here too.
Absolutely.
I think that sounds like a great idea.
Hopefully it can help some people because they're going to need it.
Well, that's good. So Robin, we'll coordinate and make that happen. Well, thank you very much. And we really do look forward to it. So now, John LeMay, the man of the hour, tell us, you are here because you have done research into the field of Jaws, the great part myth, part legend, part fact monster from the sea. Give us an overview of what you have done and what you know. How about that?
Well, you know what's funny is we've been talking about aliens this whole time, and I specifically was researching the development of the Jaws movies and their unmade versions, and actually in Jaws 2 and Jaws 3, there was some ties to aliens and UFOs. Not in real life, but I mean, in one of the stories they integrated a UFO, believe it or not, and in another one they integrated aliens, and hopefully we can talk about just all the wild paths Jaws almost went down in its sequels, which are pretty crazy. But, you know, I've done 30 books now, and of the 30 books, my bestseller by far, and it's really shocked me, is my book Jaws Unmade, because, again, it's all about the Jaws movies that they almost made, but they didn't, you know. The path's not taken with different screenplays and directors and things like that. But gosh, that book, it outsells all my UFO books, all my dinosaur books, my Godzilla books. It's crazy. So people really love Jaws.
But, oh, they do.
Oh, absolutely. And I think what it is, I mean, because I always compare my Jaws book to my King Kong book, Kong Unmade, and I kind of puzzle over why Jaws outsells Kong Unmade. But I finally figured, you know, Kong, its big milestone was 1933 when it first came out, and there's not very many people alive today that actually saw King Kong in theaters in 1933, but there are still a lot of people who saw Jaws when they were teenagers or children during the first run in theaters. So maybe that's why that book sells so much better. But yeah, anything y'all want to know about Jaws in terms of the writing process, hopefully I'll be able to remember it. But after John said, it was partially inspired by kind of, sort of, you know, the real-life incident from 1916 where the sharks swam up the river. So what happened was in the mid-1960s, Peter Benchley, the author of Jaws, you know, he read about that story, and it kind of stuck in his mind just in the sense of, what if there was a shark that hung around a certain area and it just wouldn't go away and it wouldn't leave and you know, the town had to band together to kill it. And, you know, kind of just gestated in his mind for several years. And then I think in the early 1970s, he was meeting with a publisher about something. And it wasn't about his book Jaws, not at all. It was about something else entirely. And just kind of like how we go off on tangents here, you know, Peter eventually started talking to this publisher about how he had kind of been trying to write a book about a shark attack. And the publisher was like, well, I'd actually rather have you do that for me. Can you finish the shark story? So Peter Benchley, that's what kind of set Jaws on the path to finally being finished. And it wasn't called Jaws initially. They really didn't know what to call this book. I think one of the first titles for it was Leviathan Rising. And then another title for Jaws was Stillness in the Water. And Peter eventually kind of had a tough time writing it, because initially when he gave his first draft to the publisher, the only scene they liked in the whole first draft was the first scene where the shark eats the girl, and they kind of didn't like what followed. And so Peter eventually felt like, well, maybe I'm taking this thing too seriously. So his second draft of Jaws was kind of like a spoof, and nobody's ever seen that draft of it. It's too bad. That would be interesting. But, of course, the publisher didn't like the spoof angle either. And then I think on the third try, eventually, finally, got a version that they liked. And it has a lot of the same characters from the film, but it's very different in certain ways. You know, Jaws is a movie so many people have seen so many times, I don't think the plot really needs too much repeating. But you remember you've got Sheriff Brody. You've got ichthyologist? How what do you say for a fish biologist? How do you pronounce that?
Ichthyologist.
Okay, thank you, Trey. I guess I could just say marine biologist. I can pronounce that. But you've got Hooper, the marine biologist, played by Richard Dreyfuss, and then you've got Quint, the professional shark hunter. Well, in Jaws, the book, it has a big subplot where when Hooper comes into town, Sheriff Brody's wife and Hooper used to know each other and kind of run in the same social circles. And while Sheriff Brody is busy hunting the shark, those two have an affair. And it's not really a very likable subplot. And then I think it kind of helps form the crux of the ending where Sheriff Brody has to go out on the high seas with this man that has been having an affair with his wife, and they have to kill the shark together. And in the book also, Hooper dies. And it was actually like that in the original screenplay for quite a while. Hooper originally died. The shark was supposed to, like, kind of rear out of the water with him in his mouth and bite him in half. But just for various reasons during filming, they didn't do it. But the producers who wanted to make Jaws, they told Peter Benchley, you know, take out that affair subplot. We really don't like that. And I think that was a wise decision.
Well, I think the thing about Jaws that to me is so appealing is that, well, it is based on that 1916 shark attack. And, you know, that it took them 2 days to catch that shark in Raritan Bay is what I'm reading. And they had a 300-pound bull shark, which was going upstream in fresh water. And then they had, when they dissected it, they had 15 pounds of human remains in the stomach. So that was evidently the same shark that had attacked these people. But because it's, I think it puts a temperament on a shark that's like a vengeful human. So it really combines a lot of things that would make it scary and adventuresome and wild and predictably unpredictable. I mean, it's just like somebody who's just the shark really has had it, and he's just not going to take it anymore, and he seeks revenge on humans. It's a very, very, very scary and realistic thriller.
Yeah, I was really surprised.
Yeah.
A few years ago, well, actually more than a few years ago, when I first watched the Jaws movies, and of course I was like everybody else, I was enthralled with them, except I was scared to death in the beginning. And then after I got over it, you know, when they started playing where you could get it at home, so I was in my own setting, I wasn't quite as fearful. I don't watch scary movies to begin with. But then I was obsessed with all of them, and I couldn't watch them enough. Like, it was very intriguing to me. And then I found out about what really started it, you know, and then it really made more sense to me. You know, the bull sharks, and we have had this actually happen in Michigan, the bull sharks adapt. Those things, they're ridiculous, and they are more aggressive than a lot of other types anyway, but they will adapt to anything, and they've actually had them go through the Sioux Locks in Michigan, and they pulled them out of Traverse City Bay.
Really?
They,
that far inland?
Yeah. they pulled a 5-foot female out of there, and then they got another time they got a young pup. And I think there was two other instances that fishermen have got them. They've never had anybody get attacked, but the theory that they always put out was that they went in through the lock because the Sioux Locks is up there. Whether or not that's how they got in or not, I think somebody's speculation. They never saw anything go through the locks, but they've had them in the bay. And these bull sharks, they don't care how little water. They don't care if it's harsh gravel on the bottom. They don't care if it cuts the bottom of their belly up. They are nasty enough and aggressive enough that they will literally kill and consume anything moving. And so when I read the article about, you know, what had happened going, you know, up the river and these people that had been killed, it made more sense. And then I found out that that's where Jaws came from. Then years after I found this information out, there's actually a movie out about that for anybody out there that wants to actually see the film reconstructing what happened in that situation. There is a movie out about it. And I'm sorry I don't remember offhand. I'll have to Google it and check what they called it. But it's a very, very good movie. And it's based on what really happened when those people got killed. You know, I mean, back then, you have to remember, we know so much more about sharks and shark behavior and more things because of, you know, the TV and the internet and all these other, you know, media things. More information is out there about the shark attacks. They just had somebody, and it wasn't around here. I mean, it was on the other side of the globe, that was paragliding, and they think it was a black-tip shark, and it came right out of the water and grabbed the guy by the foot. And they actually had a video about it on the internet. Guy lost his foot, you know. And so we get more information about all these attacks now. Back then, there was no information. There was no way to get it out to warn people. So these things would happen, and more people would just keep, you know, getting hurt. But these bull sharks are tenacious. And I was reading about it again today. I was kind of just glancing through it, and it had a couple things that said, you know, they know a bull shark was involved, and they think possibly a white shark. But in anything I've ever read prior to that, it was always the bull shark that had done it. And it was the same one, because like you had said, Trey, when they gutted it, there was remains of people.
Right, right. They found human remains. You know, I know my brother's got a friend who used to do diving in the coastal Carolina area for the big megalodon teeth. And, you know, the visibility in these tidal rivers is like a foot if you're lucky. And mainly it's done by feel. And I asked him about this friend that did that because he was interested in finding a megalodon tooth himself. But he said really the only way he thinks he could find it is if he went diving, and he doesn't dive. And I said, well, how about your friend? He says he doesn't dive anymore. And the reason he doesn't dive anymore is I thought he was going to say he had an encounter with like a bull shark or something that went up into the brackish water. He said, no, this guy, he says he was diving, and all of a sudden there was a pressure on top of him that would not let him come up. Now, can you imagine that? You're diving in near zero visibility, and all of a sudden you're not allowed to come up. And then he said, then the pressure went away, and he came up and broke the surface and decided not to go back into the water. But I thought
smart.
He was going to say he felt something big brush up against him, which certainly could happen. But he said it felt like somebody was holding him down. And it wasn't human, that's for sure.
Yeah. And they claim people that have actually been bit by him. They said it just feels like you are hit by a freight train.
Yep. Mm. Well, when Jaws came out, that was a blockbuster. And it created economic hazards to all these coastal communities that depend on tourists going into the water. I mean, that really disrupted a lot of ocean-going people. And it still carries over today. If people have seen Jaws, They're a little more suspicious of going into the water still today. Mm-hmm. But at the time it came out, I think that had a pretty big impact on lots of resort destinations.
I agree. Okay. I agree. And, you know, you get these towns like Myrtle Beach and up the East Coast and even the West Coast in California. But, you know, their livelihood is tourism.
Mm-hmm.
And I have to agree with Trey. It seems to me like when Jaws first came out, I heard a lot about that, how it really made a negative impact on tourism. People were terrified.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Yeah.
And, but some of these, like the black tips and the reef sharks, and especially, again, the bull sharks, they come right up on shore. I mean, they'll get as close to the shore as they can. They don't care if half their body's out. And every now and then, you'll see these things that'll be on, you know, on the news where people are finding them washed up on shore because they get so far up there chasing the little tiny schools of fish, and then the waves go back out, and they're stranded. I mean, the great whites have done it too, but it's more predominantly, you notice it in these reef sharks, the black tip, the bulls, you know. But they'll go up any waterway they can get to, the bull sharks. They don't, nothing slows them down.
Hmm.
Well, I can tell, this is Dr. John, I can tell you that whenever somebody sees a shark, it always makes front page news. In the Sun News, they are all about it because people around here in the Myrtle Beach area are still afraid of sharks. And about every other year, we have a report of a shark and or two or whatever, and it is frightening. And it does keep people from going in the water. I mean, I think today they just come to the beach and they just don't go in. But they are afraid of sharks. They really are. And it makes a big impact. It does.
Well, I know pilots that fly along the coastline, they often do see sharks right beyond the surf line. And
yeah.
I would think with increased use of drones,
them?
I think you're going to see a lot more sightings of sharks along beaches because it gives you an eye in the sky for a lot more people than just a single pilot.
Well, that and drones are taking pictures of lots of crazy things, and they have pictures of sharks now. We don't have too many drone shots from Myrtle Beach, and I guess that might be the reason why. But they're very careful about that because it does affect the economy, and it is frightening. And the idea of being bit by a shark is something, I mean, that just terrifies me no end. I was caught in some undertow and almost died, but I think if I'd had a shark coming after me down in Sullivan's Island, excuse me, it would have been just almost too much for me. I was lucky that I didn't have anything like that. And now, Velvet, do you guys get many reports of sharks down there in the Charleston area? I guess I don't hear about them because I'm living in Myrtle Beach. Do y'all have many sharks down there? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, we get a few. They've been tracking a couple of great whites that have been tagged that have been around the Hilton Head area recently, and they've gotten within just under 10 miles offshore. So that's a little scary because for great whites, that's a little close. But they're creeping closer every year. But the tiger sharks and the bull sharks have been getting within 2 miles of the shore. So they can get up as close as to 4 foot of water, and you would never know. You know, if you're walking out in the water and you got waist deep and you're about, you know, you're having fun, they can come up and really, really get you. But they try not to overemphasize that from the beaches we have here because of exactly what people have said already, tourist off and this and that, and plus being, you know, trying to open up after COVID, you know, everybody's broke. They're trying to make a couple of bucks. So nobody's saying anything right now about it. But, yes, we have some lingering. And, you know, Folly Beach, when we have a swell like this, the surfers will go out, and they usually get bit during something like this because, you know, the sharks are getting, you know, the food is being depleted, there's food supply, so it's like, yeah, they're coming a little closer and closer every year. But yeah,
I remember back in 2014, I think it was, I came down here to visit my daughter and her family, and we all went to the beach, and there was a bunch of fishermen there, and we, you know, we walked out in the water, and I, of course, I'm like on high alert because I'm always afraid of, you know, my kids are out in that water and the sharks and everything, and there were fishermen there, and they said they were out the day before, and they were like thigh deep in the water, and they had, they didn't know what kind of shark it was, just that a shark came up because they had bait attached to them. I don't know what kind of fishing they were doing, but they had side of them.
Yeah.
And
so that probably wouldn't be a good idea.
No, but
I know.
They do that.
And one came up, and a guy got bit right in the thigh.
Yep.
And that was the day before we were there.
Mm. I mean, it happens.
And I thought, okay,
I mean,
and you're an idiot.
Pretty much, but they do it all the time. They like to do that, that surf fishing, basically is what they call it, and they'll stand waist deep sometimes, and yeah, they have bait on them. It's not smart.
No, I think it would be better than that. And my son was the was an aquarium boy at the Columbia Zoo, and he used to go into the shark tank where the little Pacific sharks are. And one of them took a nip at him, but it was a small shark. It didn't
right.
do any permanent damage. And he was wearing a wetsuit, and it didn't break skin or anything. But, you know, they're just fish, and they're just looking for a snack. And when food's available, they're gonna go for whatever they think they can get a chunk of.
Yeah, when Michael's leg is there, they're going to go biting, aren't they? Whoa.
Especially if you see a little pale thing flashing around, it just looks like lunch.
That is just frightening. It really is, because we have no control over that. We can.
No, but by the same token, John, if you go to Times Square, you can get shot now. So I mean, it's just pick your poison. You can go to Times Square and get shot by a drive-by shooting, or you can go to Myrtle Beach and get nibbled on by a shark. I don't know which one of those.
That's right. Let's go.
Well, and it's the same thing, and we've talked about this when we talked about the Bigfoots. When you leave your house, you are now in their world. You are in their yard once you leave your home. If you go in the woods, you're in their area. When you go into the water, these oceans, you're now in their world. And they've talked about it before, and I've seen it where, you know, the guys that are on the surfboard, they actually think they're a seal. They don't understand it's a person, and they normally don't like the taste of us, you know. So some of them, they'll bite, and then they let them go because they don't like the taste of it, you know. But then there's, you know, if they're hungry enough, they're going to grab it, and they shake it and tear it and eat it because that's what they do. But they don't realize that they're hunting humans. They just think it's a food source because it's in the water that they eat out of.
We were in the Florida Keys once, and we were snorkeling off the end of a jetty. And at the base of the jetty, about, I don't know, 12 feet of water maybe, there was a whole bunch of nurse sharks. They're all just laying around on the bottom. They weren't swimming. They were not swimming, but they were just laying on the bottom. And, you know, they ranged in size from maybe 6 feet to 4 feet to smaller, a little larger. But it is kind of a moment when you recognize the fact that you've got a whole bunch of sharks just laying on the bottom, but they're just right off the end of this jetty. People are fishing and swimming and having fun, and here's a whole bunch of sharks right underneath you.
Yeah.
That is just, again, that's just frightening. It's just too frightening. That would have been like being in Seattle this past summer, and you just don't know what's going to happen, if everything's going to be okay or what. That's just frightening. Well, now, John, getting back to you, because you've got a lot of expertise, tell us a little bit about your book, Jaws Unmade, and tell us about, can you cite a couple of the unmade films that we did not become fortunate enough to see?
Yeah, actually, there's quite a few unmade films in the wake of Jaws 3D. That's probably got the most interesting developmental process of all of them. Like, for instance, you know, we all remember Jaws 3D is kind of gimmicky, and it takes place at SeaWorld, right? The shark gets in and attacks SeaWorld. The original story for Jaws 3 was much more grounded, and it was actually, again, based even more closely on that 1916 incident with the sharks swimming up the freshwater river. And it was written by Richard Matheson, who had also written I Am Legend, you know, pretty well-known vampire film. You know, they did the one starring Vincent Price as Last Man on Earth, and Charlton Heston as the Omega Man. So the writer of that took a stab at Jaws, and he looked at that story for inspiration. So his idea was that the shark would swim up the river just in real life, but it gets stuck in a lake, and there's a fishing community by the lake, and no one, you know, suspects that there's this giant shark in the lake, so they can't figure out why all these people are dying, and it sounds pretty spooky. But you know how studio executives are. The studio executives felt like you needed to have characters from Jaws 1 and 2 in the movie, which is really dumb because you don't need – all you need is the shark. It's kind of – that's probably the silliest thing about the Jaws franchise is that, you know, Jaws 3 is set in Florida, but, you know, Chief Brody's sons have moved to Florida, and they fight a shark there. Then in Jaws 4, Chief Brody's son moves to, I think, the Bahamas, and the shark follows him there. So it gets pretty dumb. You know, they really should have just come up with new characters. But anyways, that was partly why in Jaws 3D, they just thought it would be cooler to relocate it to SeaWorld and bring in the Brody boys. So otherwise, I like Jaws 3D, though. But now, before that, though, before Richard Matheson came along, it was even weirder. Because Jaws 3 was going to be a straight-up parody spoof produced between Universal and National Lampoon's, believe it or not. And the title was Jaws 3 People Zero, kind of like a scoreboard.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, and I think how that came about. Okay, so when they were shooting Jaws 2, they had a bunch of teenage actors on the set. And the teens, one of them, I think his name was Keith Gordon. I feel bad, I can't remember. But one of the actors playing one of the teens on the sailboats, he wrote a Jaws spoof script, which was basically about the making of Jaws 2, and it was a satire of what was going on behind the scenes of shooting. And he made a copy of the script, and he was handing it around to his friends. And to his horror... his absolute horror, his, you know, because he's, you know, he's just a teenage actor. He's not, you know, somebody big like Roy Scheider. And his spoof script finds its way into the hands of the big producer, David Brown. And so he's just mortified, thinking, oh, gosh, he's going to fire me. He's going to hate it, because he actually kind of sort of pokes a little bit of fun at the producers in his little spoof script. But instead, David Brown loved it. He just thought it was hilarious. And this is what I think is so interesting. I've never, ever seen David Brown or Richard Zanuck admit that these teen actors gave them the idea to do a spoof. But I did see David Brown in an interview on video. He actually said, yeah, during the ending of Jaws 2, I was already thinking about making Jaws 3 a parody. And this is what always just really irks me about Hollywood people, is they always steal each other's ideas, and they never give each other credit. So I really think that this teen actor came up with that concept, and the producer would just never credit it to him. But anyways, that's why I think they decided to make Jaws 3 an outright parody. And there's some pretty funny scenes in there, like the first scene of Jaws 3 People Zero was going to be Peter Benchley, and he's sitting down at his typewriter, and you see him type out Jaws 3, and he's trying to think of what to write, and he gives up because he can't think of anything. And he goes out and dives into a swimming pool, and the shark is in the swimming pool, and it eats him, and that's the type of movie it is. You know, again, it's National Lampoon, so it's kind of like Airplane, or, you know, where the sense of reality is a little distorted.
I could just see Peter Graves in Jaws 3. That would be great. That would just be great.
Yeah, I'm trying to think who they had cast in that, but they got pretty far along in production. Several scripts were written, and the whole premise of the movie was just that they're trying to shoot Jaws 3, but there's a real shark on the loose that's eating people. And now if you look up, you know, like what's the plot of Jaws 3, People Zero on the internet, you'll get some misinformation that that Jaws is an alien shark in that, and it's not actually true. What it is there's this producer who's out to sabotage the making of Jaws 3. So he hires, like, the worst director he possibly can, and this director comes up with the idea that Jaws 3 should be about these aliens trying to take over Amity Island, and one of the aliens is the shark. So it's kind of like a movie within a movie, that sort of thing. I guess the movie, you know, Jaws 3, People Zero ends, and you find out that the evil producer hired the shark to eat people and sink the production. And again, that's why I say the reality is distorted, because the producer can talk to the shark and, you know, stuff like that. So it's pretty silly, but it is funny.
John LeMay, I've got a technical question for you. These movies that are not made. Now, I understand if somebody writes a script for a movie and then everybody passes on it, and then that's the end of it. But the movies that actually go into production and then, for whatever reason, they say, we're not going to do this, and everybody goes home. Do the actors that were hired to be in the movie, do they still get paid? They get paid something for showing up and to do with their job, even though the movie was canceled, or... How does that work?
Yes, yeah, so that leads me into two different stories. So number one, there's this policy in Hollywood called pay or play, which means you get paid up front, and if you don't get to shoot it, you know, in other words, you don't get paid, you don't play, you still got your paycheck and you don't have to give it back. So there's pay or play. Now that's typically only with, like, directors and stuff like that who are hired during the pre-production process. Now you've given me a good segue into Jaws 2. Jaws 2 began shooting with a different director and a partially a different cast. Now, of course, you know, Roy Scheider, he was, you know, he had to come back as Sheriff Brody. But when I say a different cast, most of the teenagers were different actors. Chief Brody's sons were both different actors, and the youngest son was actually Ricky Schroeder, who later became famous on NYPD Blue. He played the youngest son originally in Jaws 2. And I think they shot it for like a month, and eventually Universal just decided they did not like this director. They hired John Hancock, and they fired him. And when the new director came on, he fired most of the teenagers, not all of them, but most of them. And so, I mean, to answer your question, basically, I mean, yeah, those teens, even though their footage was never used, they definitely got paid. Their pay might have just been cut short because they didn't end up working longer than a month. But
it might have been just cheaper to have the sharks eat the teenagers right off the bat. and that way you could get a new cast. But, you know, you could still use the footage you shot to begin with. Because, like in horror films, teenagers always get eaten, shot, killed, murdered by whatever the horror figure is. And right after they say, we better get some rest, or why don't we split up? Those are those, to me, that's exactly what, then you know you're going to have deaths of teenagers on film.
Well, and
right.
Speaking of, like, you're talking about slasher movies, do y'all remember the Jaws ripoff Orca, the killer whale?
Oh, yes.
Yeah, that's a guy. I don't even like to call that a ripoff because it's really pretty original and it's a really good movie. But they wanted to make this terrible sounding sequel. They wanted to do Orca Part 2. And it sounds so zany. You know, the producer of Orca was the Italian producer Dino De Laurentiis, who also did King Kong. And he had a couple of different ideas how to bring back Orca. One was actually to do King Kong versus Orca, which really sounds crazy. I think that was just the title he blurted out one day, and, you know, fans like me have kind of ran with it. But Dino did develop an Orca Part 2, And he had Joe Dante, you know, who did Gremlins and a bunch of other movies. Joe Dante was trying to develop Orca too, and he was really having trouble with Dino De Laurentiis. And I heard this interview of Dante imitating Dino De Laurentiis and what De Laurentiis was telling Dante he wanted Orca to do. And he's like, oh, I want Orca to go crazy. He's going to come on land and he's going to kill people. So Dino De Laurentiis wanted Orca somehow to come on land and start killing people. And I tried to, and then part of the story was going to be that these cops are trying to solve the murders and they find seaweed at the crime scenes, and that's part of the clues. And I'm trying to really think how this would have worked, because I really don't think he would have waddled that far on land. And I did some research, and it's kind of like Robin was talking about with the certain types of sharks earlier, and I guess certain types of killer whales sometimes will lunge at the beach so hard that to grab a seal that they will actually come onto land very briefly, and then they kind of have to waddle around and wait for the tide. Yeah, and so that's what I think is.
I tell you what, when I went to visit my son in Vancouver, and this was several years ago, he took me on a whale watching expedition around Vancouver Island. And we were in what I thought was a decent sized boat. And you had all these rows of seats that people could sit in. So we're on this boat, and they have spotters that go out ahead of you to see where the orcas are at. And, you know, then they turn that way and they do this big loop so you can go out in them. You don't realize how insignificant and tiny you are until you have a large pod of killer whales around your boat, because whenever they dive in the water, it makes the waves go and it tips your boat on the side.
Wow.
And then they come right up next to the side of the ship. And when we were there, they had a few calves with them, and it was also breeding season. And we had these huge males trying to breed the females, and they're, of course, slapping around in the water, which creates these massive waves. And this boat that we were in, that when we left the dock, I thought, oh, you know, I would say it was probably 30, 35 feet. You know, that's not an itty-bitty boat. That's it may be 40 feet. It's a decent size. You don't realize that until you're out there that when they go under, they create waves from underneath, and that sends that boat flying. And then when they come up on the side and they're slapping around, this boat would go on its side. And you're thinking to yourself, these are killer whales. These aren't a blue whale. You know, or something like that. Can killer whales that kill?
But then again, you know, Robin, the activity that they're engaged with, they'd be kind of distracted, I would think. They wouldn't be on the make for lunch.
They were coming up and bumping the side of the boat. No, they'd come up and bump the side of the boat.
They're just frisky at that point.
Yeah, and then when we went around this one bend, there was this huge rock cluster that had nothing but sea lions on it. And so we stopped the boat so we could all watch the sea lions, and the male was out there. And the male is just a screaming and a hollering because he had, you know, all the females were there. And this guy comes around the corner in a flipping little kayak, not knowing that they were all, you know, on these rocks. And Fisher filled in the water. I mean, it was like the perfect storm. And this guy in the kayak goes right through the jellyfish, and he must have got too close to the rocks, because that big old male come flying off the rocks, and he was headed for that kayak. And the guy in the kayak is trying to get over to our boat in case we need to grab him and pull him up, you know. And then 50 feet from that are the killer whales, and I'm looking at that guy, and I'm thinking, you have stupid written on your forehead. One of those three are going to take you home for dinner, buddy.
Yeah, if he had a nice brightly colored kayak, it would be like a, I don't know, the equivalent of an orca snow cone.
I'm telling you, because you just don't realize.
Like shaved, there's Hawaiian shaved ice and there's Pacific Northwest shaved ice, I guess.
But you just don't realize that when you get in the water with these things, the waves, I didn't think anything about it. Get on a boat, go out there, we can tour around and see them, you know, swimming and everything. Never in my wildest of imaginations did I think about the fact that they create waves which capsize boats. It was wonderful. I would honestly go back out again. But it was wonderful. I'd do it again, but I tell you, there was a few scary moments there.
Well, sea creatures can be very large. One of my best memories of diving. Actually, we weren't diving. We were snorkeling because we could do this easier. It was in it was across from the Kona Airport in Hawaii, and we held bright lights toward dusk. We held bright lights as it got dark, and we shined them down into the water, and it attracted all sorts of little creatures. And then these enormous manta rays, I mean enormous manta rays, would do barrel rolls and feed. And as they'd do these barrel rolls, they'd come up underneath you with their mouths open, and you could reach out and let your hand slide along them as they're doing barrel rolls. Amazingly graceful animals, but enormous, just enormous. Mother Nature.
That's right. Now, this is Dr. John. I've got a two-part question for John LeMay. Number one, I spent all weekend with my friends getting away from work and everything, and so I ended up watching nothing but Travel Channel Paranormal. And I sent you a text message, John LeMay. This is part one of my two-part question. All they were talking about was Area 52. I'd heard of it, but they were making it sound like it was the biggest, most secret thing in the world. And you replied, it's a drag strip.
I assume they're talking about the same Area 52. I mean, all I can say is we have a drag strip here in Roswell. I think it's called Area 52. Maybe they called it Area 51. I don't know. We have an Area 52. I'm pretty sure it's Area 52 drag strip here in Roswell. So I assume they're talking about the same thing. I don't know.
Probably. But it was so funny when you talk about misinformation. But then we can get from the sublime to the ridiculous. You told me that there had been what was the spoof? It was Billy the Kid versus who?
This is my own idea. Oh, well, this is my own idea. While we were in the green room talking to John and Billy, and for first-time listeners, something interesting to know is that, you know, most everybody on ScaryCast I've never met face-to-face, but Billy the Kid and I have had several adventures out here in New Mexico. So Billy and I are buddies and had spent quite a bit of time together out on the range doing stuff in New Mexico. And I was trying to think of something fun for Jaws tonight since Billy's on here. So when we were in the green room, so to speak, before the show, we were talking to them, and I said that I had an idea for a movie. And since they had done Billy the Kid versus Dracula back in the 60s, I thought maybe we could do Billy the Kid versus Jaws.
Billy, what do you think about that?
Yeah.
Oh, that'd be cool. I mean, yeah. Make that happen,
but
man. That'd be pretty cool.
Well, okay. Well, here's the story, because I've been thinking of it. I really put some serious thought into this. I don't think Universal would actually let us do Billy the Kid versus Jaws, but I heard Velvet mention Sharknado earlier. And, you know, The Asylum produces the Sharknado movies, and they love those. So I was really thinking maybe The Asylum would let us do Billy the Kid versus Sharknado. And what happens is somehow these sharks swim up the Pecos River into Lincoln County, New Mexico. And then a tornado hits and sucks the sharks out of the river. So they're flying around in the air, and Billy has to shoot them. And then, there's more. Like the pillow guy says, there's more. The final shark, though, swallowed Pat Garrett whole, And then as the final shark's like flying through the air, Pat Garrett pops out of its mouth shooting at Billy, and then Billy's got to shoot Pat Garrett out of the shark, and that's how it would end. And then I was thinking, because those sharks really did swim up the river back in 1916, the tagline for Billy the Kid versus Sharknado could be based on a true story.
Absolutely.
Yeah. That just rings of authenticity. Here's a spin, and you can take credit for this when it goes to the big production. You can just write my name as a thanks for an idea from Trey Dunaway. But here's my idea. Now I'm thinking orca to go on land to eat people. That's not very realistic. You know, that's just not very realistic. But there are walking catfish, right?
Yeah, there is.
Mm-hmm. So let's say there's a cross between a bull shark and a walking catfish. And that the walking mutant catfish with the dental work of a bull shark, then you have a walking catfish bull shark. That could go against Billy the Kid, and they could face off as they walk toward each other and have a shootout.
Well, it's really not any crazier than Billy the Kid versus Dracula, so that could work.
Well, but
yeah.
I've got to add something.
Yeah.
This has got to take place at beautiful Lake Wateree on a little small peninsula that has a beautiful house and an American flag and a cannon in the yard. Right, Trey?
Billy the Kid could crawl up. He could be wounded by the walking catfish bull shark, and he could walk up. He could climb his way out of the lake, find his way to a Revolutionary War cannon, and then plug the walking catfish bull shark with a cannon.
Right.
I think it would be a huge hit. Huge hit. You can see it already. It'd be a tourist mecca for people to come to see where it was filmed.
Don't y'all have
or not?
Was it Bigfoot versus Lizard Man? Aren't y'all doing Bigfoot versus Lizard Man first?
Well, you know, you could have all three of them. You could have the walking bull shark catfish with Lizard Man, and then you could have Billy the Kid come in and clear up the misunderstanding between Lizard Man and the walking catfish bull shark. And at the end, they could all be sitting around a campfire singing Kumbaya, and they could all get along well. That wouldn't be a good ending. They'd have to have some death and destruction and mayhem in order to make it work with Hollywood.
That's right. And but Trey, the final battle would take place right next to, there's a famous ship that is shipwrecked on Lake Wateree. It is the SS Biden, and it's kind of like a cut down version of the SS Minnow. Now there really is. They showed it to me today, and we could involve the SS Biden in this whole thing, and we probably get. I mean, Joe's a big believer in Rumble, so we probably get Joe to come down and do a guest spot in it.
We had a flood on our lake with the storms this early spring, and some poor sailboat got stuck, floated up. When the water went down, it got hung up on a log, so the thing's sticking out of the water, and it's a derelict now. And some wag painted SS Biden on it. Then it would have those political overtones, and then you'd have, you could do it with like the Rio Grande. You could have it involving migration from the Southwest across the Rio Grande on the back of walking catfish bull shark people and Billy the Kid there on the Rio Grande. Of course, it's a drought, so the Rio Grande would only be like 3 inches deep. So it would, you do have to have smaller walking catfish. I tell you, it's difficult to come up with a good movie plot to make sense, which is why a lot of them don't make sense. They just give up on making sense and just say, well, we'll just do this for the action scene.
Right.
Yes.
And what we'd have to do, along with Billy the Kid, we'd have to have several wrestlers, partners, like the great Susan Green, Maestro, and, of course, the Amazing Velvet. And, I mean, it could not get any better than that. And you know what? Something like that could be a huge hit at the drive-in.
It could be. If you did it in 3D, you could have the wrestlers tossing the bull shark walking catfish against the rope and having them bounce out toward the audience in 3D. Now, that would be terrifying.
There you go.
Yeah, we'll use that. We'll use everybody on this broadcast to be part of this mayhem, and it'll be a huge hit. It'll be a bigger hit than Jaws. I mean, nobody will believe it. I guarantee you, nobody will believe this film. And John LeMay will have all the writing credit with it from an idea by Trey Donaway. John, this is exactly what we need to work on, don't you think?
I think that is a very worthy investment of our time, and it will pay off very well. If Devin was here, he'd probably agree.
You never know. And, of course, it'll be starring the original Billy the Kid, William H. Cox II. We will have wrestlers galore in it. We will have Susan Green and Robin McRae singing Kumbaya by the fire. Robin, you will not believe how much fun this will be. It'll probably be a huge hit. So now everybody.
We'll have to change Kumbaya so it has the bum 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 theme to it too. The Jaws theme version of Kumbaya. Yes.
And she has to scream really loud at the end.
Oh my God!
That is funny though. Yeah, and Jaws. They did have the same characters. It's like grudge matches of Jaws, where wherever these four people went, there was a shark waiting to get them in a grudge match.
That's right.
Well, I just think this would be better at Lake Watery, near the dam down there, and then we have the SS Biden, and then we have, of course, the palatial mansion with the U.S. flag and the cannon. I mean, there could be nothing better. I mean, everybody in the world now knows what we really do with our time. When we get on the phone, we talk about stuff like this, and lo and behold, it may happen. There's no telling, because I got to talk to John May about something after this and everything. But I'll tell you what, we got time to run around the ring. Yes, as we use that great wrestling motif, we got to run around the ring. We got to see what everybody's got to plug. We've just gone through a great holiday. We're going to be on, of course, WLSC AM and FM, Banana Jack's radio station. This is going to be on Saturday night, midnight. And by the way, just to remind everybody, Pro Wrestling Interviews moving to a new time, 8 p.m., Sunday nights, Pro Wrestling Interviews starring the one and only Amazing Velvet. And then, of course, we've got Robin, the Queen of Scary Cast. We've got the Surgeon General of Scary Cast, Dr. Trey Donaway. We've got, of course, the Amazing Velvet with us again. We'll even invite Billy the Kid. We're probably going to invite you next week. You'll be kind of fun. You'll be kind of fun when we talk to the head of the Flat Earth Society, Mark Sargent, and we're just going to have a blast. We have more fun on Scary Cast. We're a lot more fun Coast to Coast AM. They don't have any soul. They have no fun. We have fun, and we talk about great things, and they have fake personalities. They have George Norrie. We've got real personalities. Everybody on here is a real crazy personality.
If we don't know the answer to something, we can make it up on the spot.
We can.
Trey,
you're absolutely correct.
You just said it. It's the truth. We just make it up. We don't care. It's a lot of fun. So anyway, I'm going to go around the ring and see who all has something to plug for this coming week. And we're going to finish up with, of course, Billy the Kid's prognostication on the hurricane. So, Billy, you better get your psychic vibe ready, because the last person we're going to talk to is you, and you're going to tell us where the storm is going to go. And we'll be on WLSC AM and FM midnight, this coming midnight on Saturday night, and we'll be able to see if you were right or wrong. So get ready to prognosticate, and I'm going to start with the Queen of Scary Cat, Robin McCrae. Tell us about the conferences that you're going to be going to and all about that. That sounds like fun.
Yeah, July 17th in Ann Arbor, Michigan is a conference being put on by the Lost Cryptid Society, and I will be there for the 17th, and then I am going from there because that's where all my family is at, and I'm going to be for the next week after it. I will be visiting my children, my grandchildren, and my mother, my sister, and her family. Haven't seen them in a while, so definitely a visit is long overdue. So I go the 15th of July, and I will be back the 27th. And the nice thing about this particular conference is they are going to cover not only the flesh and blood part of the Bigfoot, but they will also be talking about the paranormal side, which is what I'll be doing.
That is great. Well, be sure to let us know on some Facebook posts. Tell us how everything is going, and maybe you can sneak a minute for a guest spot on ScaryCast or something. We hope we can add you with
it. I might be able to. If I can do it that Monday, I will let you know. I should know probably by the end of this week.
Well, good. Well, we hope you can. And, again, we know you'll be a big hit. They're going to love you like we love you here on the one and only ScaryCast. And so let's keep going around the ring. John LeMay, what do you have to promote and publicize our guest? And John, you have sparked more great debate tonight than we have ever had.
Yeah, well, I don't know how to take that, but yeah.
take it the best way possible, whatever that is, okay?
Yeah, well, nothing really new with me, but, I mean, again, if you enjoyed hearing me talk about Jaws Unmade, barely scratched the surface on all the wild stuff related to Jaws. There was even a Jaws spoof called Jaw Man that somebody tried to make with John. Stuff in that book, so if you like Jaws Unmade, just Google it, find it on Amazon. That's it for me.
Get a copy of it, buy a copy of it, support our great author and friend John LeMay, and boy, we sure do appreciate having you on here every month. Now, we will talk about next month in a couple weeks, but then in a month or so, maybe you can get Noe Torres back, because he was phenomenal. I'm sure he's a great co-author to have, and he was so much fun to talk to. So ask Noe if he'll
come back.
Well, that's good. He was absolutely awesome, and that's wonderful. Amazing Velvet, the greatest wrestler in Ravenel, South Carolina. What have you got to plug?
Yes. Well, pro wrestling interviews Sunday night. I guess we're at a new time.
Yeah.
I thought that was on the radio, not the actual. Okay. So, Curtis Black, who's been supposedly our guest for the past 2 weeks because of difficulties getting a hold of him and some stuff, he will be this Sunday's guest, independent wrestler out of Charlotte. Going to be pretty good. John LeMay, I have one last thing for you. You should do a Billy the Kid spoof like The Quick and the Dead. That would be awesome.
I need to watch that first. I've always wanted to, but it's with Gene Hackman, right?
Listen, it would be perfect for Billy the Kid. You would see the reference I'm making right off the rip, trust me, and you'd be
okay,
like, okay.
I'll make that my homework to watch it.
Yeah, there you go. Cool.
By the way, Amazing Velvet, that new time is for our radio broadcast on WLSC AM and FM. That will be 8 p.m. Sunday night. Then we will be live on the Internet, on the World Wide Web, with pro wrestling interviews. And, of course, we will have with us the great Susan Green, Stellar Steven, professor of wrestling. We will have Sinister with us and the whole crowd. And thank goodness we'll be done with the fourth and the fifth and everything. And thank you so much for being with us. You're always a breath of fresh ring announcing air. No, it's a lot of fun having you here. And Billy the Kid, tell us what's going to happen with the hurricane. You're our link to the hurricane down there in Florida. So come up with what you really think is going to happen, and we'll find out this coming Saturday night if you were right.
Yes, yeah, that storm's going to hit Tampa tomorrow sometime, and then it's going to cut across the state and go up the East Coast and head your way. So,
yeah.
So hopefully it won't be too bad.
So I better go down and Velvet and Rude Penny Jr. and his family, and we better take off to Lake Warren. Otherwise, and we might even see a something there, no matter what. Oh, speaking of Lake Wateree, Dr. Trey Donaway, what do you have to promote? What have you got going on?
I would like to reflect on the 445th anniversary of the birth of our nation and throw a little South Carolina history into that. Everyone knows what happened on July 4th, 1776. But a week before, June 28th, 1776, was when the Battle of Fort Sullivan was fought by British trying to invade Charleston. And this happened before July 4th. And most people think that after the defeat of Cornwallis at Yorktown, that was the end of the war. Well, that happened in October of 1781. And what happened is that the war didn't end until December the following year in South Carolina. Most people are not aware that one-third of all casualties, that's killed, wounded, and captured soldiers, occurred in South Carolina. More battles were fought in the American Revolution in South Carolina. And there are a lot of reasons why this happened, but one of the big reasons is that when the history books were rewritten after the Civil War, a lot of the patriotism of South Carolina was removed. So a lot of people don't realize that a lot of the war happened here in South Carolina. And when you come visit South Carolina, you can go on the Liberty Trails and see where a lot of this action occurred in the Lowcountry and the Midlands and even in the upcountry of South Carolina. So that's my reflection and historical thought for the day.
Yeah.
Well, that's great, and thank you very much, because, you know, since I've moved to South Carolina, I love this little place. It's a tough place. It's got more ghosts, more fighting, more wrestling. It's got more everything that I like. So what more can I say? And Robin, more paranormal. It has Robin doesn't
yeah.
This state just have everything. Well, that's
definitely
great. And so I want to say,
although it's the same way in Michigan, everywhere I go.
Yeah. So all I've got to say is thank you tonight to our guests for our very special July the 5th episode of ScaryCast. You guys are great friends. We'll be back next week with Mark Sargent of the Flat Earth Society. He'll be talking about the Flat Earth. Thank you, Dr. Trey Donaway, for getting me a line on some books and some things that we need for next week. So I wanted to say I appreciate it very much. I appreciate the tomatoes. They were great. I ate most of them on the way home.
But
anyway,
like
thanks a lot. We hope everybody has a great fifth.
Yay.
Everyone has a great 5th of July and beyond. So in order, from the Queen of ScaryCast, Robin McCrae, to our Surgeon General, Dr. Trey Donaway, to our world champion wrestler, the amazing Velvet, to Billy the Kid, and to everybody else out there, thank you so much. Thank you, Banana Jack and WLSC AM and FM, Loris Myrtle Beach, without whom we would not be all over the world. So tell your friends about ScaryCast, and we'll see you next time, next week, 9 p.m., Eastern on Sunday. On Monday. Monday, because it's Pro Wrestling Interviews on Sunday at 9 p.m. So take care. Have a great week. We'll see you next week. And thanks a whole lot. Have a good one, everybody.
All right.
Good night,
good
everybody.
Thanks.
Bye.
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 Bye. Bye.